content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Yes, we are back after a double issue last week. The date on this issue is November 12th, 2018. Cover story title, Beyond Hate. And make sure we get this feature in. We go to the interview at the back of the magazine. And this week it's called Eight Questions. Subject of the interview is Claire Foy. Time says, after earning an Emmy for The Crown and Oscar buzz for First Man, the actor dons a dragon tattoo for the girl in the spider's web. First question. Elizabeth Salander, the punk hacker you play in The Girl in the Spider's Web, is Queen Elizabeth II's polar opposite. Did you intentionally take on something totally different after The Crown? Answer. I have always tried to take on new roles in each step of my career, and Elizabeth is a rare character. Normally, the protagonist is someone people instantly love. Elizabeth holds no store in what people think of her. If anything, she sees people liking her as a dangerous thing. Question. What did you think of the character when you first encountered her in Stieg Larsson's Millennium series? Answer. She's quite revolutionary. Not because of the piercings or tattoos. She's a person who knew she wasn't going to get justice within the system because there was no room for her in that world. But she could get her own type of justice. I had never read about a woman who acted in that way. Question. Elizabeth emerged in 2005. When the first of the series' five books was published, as a vigilante who punishes men who hurt women, do you think Me Too will change how people perceive her? Answer. I've heard Me Too stories for a long time. It's just that now they're finally being reported on and discussed openly. To me, Elizabeth has always been a relevant character. Question. The one thing Elizabeth and Queen Elizabeth II have in common is that they both suppress their emotions. How do you prepare for scenes like that? Answer. In our everyday lives, we say one thing and we're thinking another. We're not honest with ourselves or other people the majority of the time. So acting is just a basic exercise in trying to be alive. Showing emotion, that's not acting, really. You want the audience to interpret what the character is thinking or feeling. Question. How do you accomplish that? Answer. Acting isn't about what I'm doing. It's about listening. What's the other person saying? Is my character moved to speak? If they do say something, why do they say it? I lean heavily on my fellow actors and are very lucky to be on set with talented people. I would be terrible at delivering monologues, I think. Question. In First Man, you play Neil Armstrong's wife, Janet, who does a lot of the emotional labor for a husband who represses his feelings. How did you understand that relationship? Answer. In our story, Neil ran away to stop himself from hurting, which is a very human thing to do. Janet was strong enough to take that burden for the both of them. She had lost her child. She lived in a reality where her husband could die at any moment. And she knew that she had to face it, confront it, and then move on. She had to keep everything running, keep Neil running, keep the image up. Question. The royal family always goes to great lengths to project a particular image. Did playing the Queen give you any perspective on their public face? Answer. Early in Elizabeth's reign, The family was held up as perfect leaders of the Church of England. They were beyond reproach. Within a decade, in the 1960s, that had completely turned on its head. Media changes so quickly, and they just live and die by public opinion. Although it seems they're a very privileged institution, the British public and the press are constantly holding them to account. Final question. Have you seen a difference in American and British reactions to the show? Answer. No, not particularly. I was quite overwhelmed by the diversity of the people who watched it and responded to it. That was true for Elizabeth, too. She's not the normal image that we're fed of what it means to be successful, to be a certain age, to be living in a certain world. Elizabeth, and that is the complete interview for Time, conducted by Ileana Docterman with Claire Foy, earning an Emmy for The Queen and Oscar buzz for First Man, and now in The Girl in the Spider's Web. Going now to the beginning of the issue, and we are at the page called For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a line drawing or a quotation or a statistic in bold, or a combination of the two. At the top of the page is the dictionary entry in bright red, groutier, broken down phonetically, groutier, G-R-O-U-T-I-E-R, adjective meaning more surly. Caption says, the 68-point word that Nigel Richards, who lives in Malaysia, played to win the World Scrabble Championship in London on October 28th. Groutier. 68-point word. In the right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 3.21. Caption explains, weight in ounces of a baby Gentoo penguin born at the Sea Life Aquarium in Sydney after its egg was, quote, fostered, unquote, by a pair of male penguins. 3.21 ounces. The story is also illustrated by, as well as the statistic, a line drawing of two large black and white male penguins, and they are framing a baby penguin who has red wings and a white front. 3.21 ounces. In the lower right margin of the page is the feature within a feature, bad week, good week. Under bad week, Johannes Kepler, NASA retired eponymous space telescope after it ran out of fuel. Under good week, Albert Einstein, a signed letter explaining theory of relativity fetched $32,500 at auction. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the number in bright red, 244. Caption explains, age in years of newspaper pages recently found at a Goodwill in Belmar, New Jersey, the December 28, 1774 edition of the Pennsylvania Journal and Weekly Advertiser features the revolutionary Unite or Die snake design and could be worth up to $16,000. December 28, 1774 in Belmar, New Jersey, found at Goodwill. In the lower left corner margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Shinzo Abe, Japan's prime minister, on his country's relationship with longtime rival China. And the quotation from Japan's prime minister, Shinzo Abe, quote, we're partners, unquote. In the middle margin on the left side of the page is a story illustrated by the number in bright red, 4. Caption explains, number of Big Bang Theory stars in the top 5 spots on the Forbes list of the highest paid TV actors. Jim Parsons is top with pre-tax income of $26.5 million for the year that ended June 1. $26.5 million. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Caitlyn Jenner, trans rights activist and reality television star, in a Washington Post op-ed after a leaked memo revealed a Trump administration proposal to narrow the legal definition of gender. And the quotation from Caitlyn Jenner, quote, believing that I could work with Trump and his administration to support our community was a mistake, unquote. In the lower center of the page is a quotation, a story illustrated by a quotation from Ali Reisman, American Olympic gymnast, calling for more changes at USA Gymnastics in light of its slow response to the abuse of athletes, including Reisman, by team doctor Larry Nassar, who is now in prison. And a quotation from Ali Reisman, American Olympic gymnast, quote, this is bigger than one abuser, unquote. In the top center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Jimmy Carter, 39th U.S. President, to Georgia's Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, in an October 22nd letter obtained by the Associated Press. Kemp is running for governor in an election overseen by his own office, a situation that Carter warned posed a risk to voter confidence. The quotation from Jimmy Carter, 39th U.S. President, in black and all caps, quote, I urge you to step aside, unquote. Caption goes on to say further, Kemp's office has been accused of stalling more than 53,000 voter registrations, about 70% of which are for people of color. The entire contents have been read now from For the Record. And going further into the front of the book, we're now at the sidebar feature called News Ticker, a collection of news items stacked one on top of the other in the right margin of the page. Top item, Venice submerged by deadly storms. Famous piazzas and streets in Venice were left underwater on October 29th after storms with winds of up to 110 miles per hour hit Italy, leaving at least 11 dead and hundreds requiring rescue. Water levels in the historic canal city were up by 1.5 meters, the fourth highest levels ever recorded. Middle item. Study finds major decline in biodiversity. A new report from the World Wildlife Fund has found a 60% average decline in population size across thousands of kinds of mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish since 1970. The growth of human consumption, specifically through agriculture, and the over-exploitation of various species is the biggest driver of the drop in biodiversity. Bottom item. U.S. urges ceasefire in Yemen war. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called on October 31st for both sides in the Yemen conflict to agree to a ceasefire. The UN has offered to lead peace talks and to end the 3-year conflict between a U.S.-backed, Saudi-led coalition and Houthi rebels, which has caused a humanitarian crisis. Moving forward, and this is a two-page photographic spread that we normally do not read from. It's called Lightbox. It is a photograph, full color, that spreads across both pages. However, we are making an exception this time to read, and the caption is self-explanatory. The title of the caption is The Thrill of Victory. Caption says, The Boston Red Sox celebrate winning another World Series, their fourth in 15 seasons, on October 28th, before finishing off the Los Angeles Dodgers 5-1 in Game 5 of the Fall Classic. The Red Sox dominated all year, winning 108 regular season games, the most for any team since 2001. Remember when Sox fans suffered through an 86-year World Series drought? A different tradition has taken hold. Photographed by David J. Phillip for AP/Shutterstock. And the photograph does indeed show the Boston Red Sox celebrating. They're running from the dugout to the pitcher and catcher who are embracing. We're now at the beginning of the major section called The View. And the lead-off section here is Nation, where the headline is The College Sports Sham by Sean Gregory. He writes, On election night, when much of the nation anxiously awaits the returns, college basketball fans will be glued to a blockbuster matchup of a different sort, a season-opening doubleheader featuring Michigan State versus Kansas, followed by Duke, Kentucky in the nightcap. ESPN is airing the entire thing in prime time. This early season clash of the sports blue blood programs will likely make for great viewing, but it should also serve as a reminder of all that's rotten at the core of America's college sports industrial complex. Consider, for example, that the four head coaches in these games, all of whom are members of the Basketball Hall of Fame, took home a combined $26.4 million in total pay in 2018, according to a salary database compiled by USA Today. Yet NCAA regulations disallow the players they coach, the ones millions will be cheering and jeering on national television, from making a market wage. This hypocrisy was thrown into fresh relief on October 24th when a jury in a New York City courthouse found that paying players isn't just a violation of the NCAA's bureaucratic rules. It now can be a federal crime. The verdict stems from a 2-year federal investigation into corruption in college basketball. Not surprisingly, to anyone even passingly acquainted with the seedy underbelly of big-time college recruiting, federal officials found a cesspool of illicit payments and kickbacks designed to attract players to certain schools. Assistant coaches, industry leaders, and hangers-on were arrested. After a 3-week trial, a jury found 3 defendants, an ex-Adidas marketing exec, a former Adidas consultant, and an aspiring sports agent, guilty of wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. Sentencing for James Gatto, Merle Code Jr., and Christian Dawkins is scheduled for March. Parenthetically, Gatto will likely appeal the case. But as in a bracket-busting upset in the March Madness tournament, there's a twist. Parenthetically, that tournament, by the way, will bring the NCAA $879 million in broadcast payments and licensing rights this season. The verdict is a chance to force college sports to operate in a more honest manner. That includes major college football, which suffers from similar shortcomings. ESPN, for example, paid $7.3 billion for the rights to air that sport's four-team playoff for a dozen years. Alabama coach Nick Saban is the state's highest-paid public employee at $8.3 million this season. Meanwhile, the kids playing the games are entitled to relatively little above the value of a scholarship. Quote, "The federal government has now proven itself ready to sink its teeth into college basketball," unquote, says Mark Edelman, law professor at Baruch College's Zicklin School of Business. Quote, "But the prosecutors missed the big issue here," unquote. That issue is being addressed in civil cases challenging the prohibition on payments to college athletes. One of the NCAA's core arguments in support of amateurism is that paying players would turn off fans and hurt the bottom line of NCAA schools. The criminal trial, however, showed the opposite. In testimony exposing college basketball's black market economy, former Adidas associate T.J. Gasnola said he paid the family of former Kansas player Billy Preston $89,000 and the guardian of current Kansas forward Silvio D'Souza $2,500 for online classes. Money is already flowing to players. Business is booming and will continue to thrive. The criminal case was a head-scratcher from the start. Federal prosecutors argued that the defendants defrauded colleges by paying players, since those payments violated NCAA rules and would make them ineligible to suit up for their schools. In effect, the defendants denied the schools the services of these athletes. So lawyers framed schools as the victims. The jury, by handing down the guilty verdict, agreed with this reading. But at the same time, the NCAA can use evidence from the trial to punish the institutions supposedly wronged here. For example, the NCAA could sanction Kansas for suiting up D'Souza a season ago when he played in 20 games. Only in the twisted world of college sports would the enterprise's governing body, the NCAA, penalize the so-called victims of a federal crime. The government should be encouraging payments for players rather than prosecuting those who tried to make that happen. There's robust economic demand for college athletic talent. Why not acknowledge this reality? Allow and regulate a market, and move on. Why force the money into the dark? Money needs to flow to the players who deserve it, no matter what a jury says. Entire article in The Opener. Article by Sean Gregory. This page also has a margin feature, sidebar, recurring feature called Short Reads, and Time Explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. Includes three items, three excerpts, stacked one on top of the other. Top excerpt, testing gender. Responding to news that the Trump administration may define gender as a fixed biological trait, effectively rolling back protections for transgender Americans, Time editor-at-large Jeffrey Kluger offers a scientific reality check. There is no genetic test that can definitively show gender. Middle item, blockchain's limitations. Blockchain, the technology behind cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, allows for the exchange of currency without banks, which has inspired optimism about its ability to empower unbanked people around the world. But financial inclusion expert Alice Mary argues such systems distract from from proven means of improving inclusion. Bottom item, political speak. Partisanship has seeped into our vocabulary, writes pollster Frank Luntz. In a focus group, many Republicans and Democrats agreed that America is, quote, exceptional, unquote, but didn't agree on what that means. Just one example of how politics is informing our shared language and values. Three samples from stories on time.com/ideas. Moving forward, and we are now in, still in The View, still in The Nation, part of The View, and we are now at the cover story, and the lead article in the cover story is The Only Way Forward by Nancy Gibbs. And Time explains, Gibbs, a former editor-in-chief of Time, is the Edward R. Murrow Visiting Professor at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Nancy Gibbs writes, Hate, among all our basic instincts, is the most distinctly human. In animals, violence and venom are tools of survival. In humans, of supremacy. Small, scared people hate. Self-hating people hate. Bullied and betrayed people hate. As though hate will make them large and safe and strong. The twisted writings of this latest class of attackers suggest they felt called to their hatreds as a duty. Robert Bowers allegedly blamed Jews for their outreach to refugees and vowed to repel, quote, invaders, unquote, moving north through Central America as he set off to the synagogue. Quote, I can't sit by and watch my people get slaughtered, unquote, an account matching his name posted like a martyr dispatched to a massacre. Accused mail bomber Cesar Sayoc stalked George Soros, the billionaire Holocaust survivor and Democratic donor, who conspiracy theorists claimed was funding that invasion. Never mind that those armed invaders were nearly 1,000 miles away, and the main thing in their arms was their children. Quote, whites don't kill whites, unquote, a witness quoted Gregory Bush as saying. He was arrested in the murders of two black shoppers at a Kentucky grocery store, allegedly having failed to get into a predominantly black church nearby. We're having a master class on hate because we've no choice. It has moved from the part of our character we work hardest to suppress to the part we can least afford to ignore. Hate slipped its bonds and runs loose through our politics, platforms, press, private encounters. And the further it travels, the stronger it grows. People unaccustomed to despising anyone ever find themselves so frightened or appalled by what they see across the divide that they are prepared to fight it hand-to-hand. Calls for civility are scorned as weak, a form of unilateral disarmament. President Trump calls for unity in the same breath that he undermines it, demonizing adversaries, minimizing threats, trivializing trauma. He didn't consider canceling a political rally out of respect for the slain. He considered it, he said, because he was having a bad hair day. So much attention is paid to the president's lies that we can miss his radical honesty. He didn't see any need to call the former presidents in the wake of assassination attempts. Quote, I think we'll probably pass, unquote, he said. That mail bomb spree was a shame, he argued, because it slowed Republicans' midterm momentum. His tweets of sympathy for the victims of the synagogue shooting were followed by color commentary on the World Series. The solution to such shootings, he suggested, was to bring back the death penalty. How better to fight violence than with more violence? And if there is a rising of dark and dangerous forces in the land, he believes, it means that, quote, the fake news media, the true enemy of the people, must stop the open and obvious hostility and report the news accurately and fairly, unquote. Likewise, the evidence of his utter lack of empathy belies his great gift and political advantage. This ability he has to sense our darkest instincts and call to them, coax them out of hiding when we'd much prefer not to see them at all. Of all the norms he violates, this is among the most disturbing, that Americans will always seek leaders who lift us up and bring us together rather than drag us down and tear us apart. Make America Great Again has been a brilliant, aspirational slogan for the resentful and aggrieved, but that road to greatness turns out to run through the smoking wreckage of institutions, values, and national honor. Gone is the joy that comes from political battle that is not a fight to the death. When politics becomes blood sport, people actually die. Here, then, is the challenge. Our normal responses aren't working. The spread of conspiracy theories as the, quote, real truth, unquote, at least presumes that truth matters, even as the theories undermine it. Social networks designed to connect friends turn out to be expertly designed to create enemies. Fact-checking makes no difference. Tribes trump truth. When reporters try to hold the president accountable for inflaming the hatred, he attacks them for bias, for fueling division. When partisans on the left call for fighting fire with fire, they validate the tactics that debase our discourse. Caught in the crossfire is a public not so much engaged in correction. Caught in the crossfire is a public not so much enraged as exhausted, at a loss to explain or escape the ugly, intellectually barren fever swamps that now pass for our public square. Conspiracy theories flourish as a substitute for the hard work of actual knowledge. They grant those who embrace them a shortcut to superiority. Average people believe what they hear on the evening news or read in the papers, but you are smarter, you know better, you see the patterns and plots behind these events, the, quote, globalists, unquote, pulling the strings, the, quote, deep state, unquote, undermining your mission. You can't be fooled. You won't be puppets. You know better. You know the truth. So what to do? The most eloquent politicians who warn of the toll this is taking are mainly the ones departing the scene. Where will we find moral leaders in an age of abdication when, quote, elites, unquote, of all kinds are suspect, whether teachers or preachers or scientists or scholars? If our past is a guide and comfort, it comes from where it always comes from. Look left, look right, not up or down. Leadership lies with the spirit of the Tree of Life synagogue, where victims included the dentist who offered his services at the free clinic, the brothers who had, quote, not an ounce of hate in them, unquote, as their rabbi said at their funeral, the couple married there more than 60 years ago, all mourned by the thousands who came out to stand vigil in silent solidarity. It lies with the postal workers going about their work, even as more mail bombs turned up, and the neighbors in Kentucky who, in the wake of the grocery store shootings, held a community meeting to discuss race and violence. If the opposite of love isn't hate, but indifference, then the antidote to hate is engagement. It comes from the people who spent the weekend knocking on doors and staffing phone banks to get out the vote on election day, from the enterprise of technologists looking for ways to drain some of the toxins from our information streams, from employees who are letting their bosses know what kind of humane, sustainable culture they expect in one of the richest countries on earth, from church groups and civic clubs and marchers raising money for clothing drives or breast cancer research or tree plantings, from teachers staying after school to tutor and coaches teaching their players about the difference between an opponent and an enemy, so they can take that wisdom with them into a public space that feels less like a sport than a war. Leadership will come from uncountable individual decisions to model kindness, to fight alienation, to get offline and into the streets or the classroom or the sanctuary and help someone in trouble. This much is clear. Whatever happens on Tuesday, no one is coming to save us. We'll have to do this ourselves. Article read in its entirety, article by Nancy Gibbs, former editor-in-chief of Time, Edward R. Murrow, visiting professor at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. In the cover story section in The Nation, this headline is, May Their Memory Be a Lesson, written by Deborah E. Lipstadt. Time says Lipstadt is Dorrit Professor of Holocaust Studies at Emory University and author of the forthcoming Antisemitism Here and Now. I was at a resort outside Phoenix, preparing for an uncharacteristically, for me that is, relaxing day. Armed with a stack of books, parenthetically, admittedly, most of them dealt with the Holocaust, I had planned a day of sitting by a pool and reading. As I crossed the grounds, a woman who had heard me speak the previous night about contemporary anti-Semitism approached, quote, Your words were prescient, unquote. Sensing my confusion, she added, quote, The shooting, Pittsburgh, the synagogue, unquote. I immediately turned to CNN and learned of the unfolding tragedy. As we now know, 11 Jews at Tree of Life Synagogue were gunned down. Some were probably there for spiritual reasons, to worship God, hear words of Torah, and pray for the sick. Others were there for fellowship, to see fellow Jews and catch up on the week's events. Parenthetically, a Jewish pundit once said, My neighbor Jacob goes to synagogue to talk to God. I, a non-believer, go to talk to Jacob. Those Jews, the regulars, as they are called in synagogue parlance, were the victims. Some were gunned down at the entrance as they donned their prayer shawls and prepared to enter the sanctuary. Others were killed inside what that morning would be anything but a sanctuary. Among the victims were many elderly. For who gets to synagogue on time? Those without kids to dress and meal tables to set. Those who, living alone, consider the synagogue their club. They also know that a minyan, or prayer quorum, which in this conservative synagogue is 10 adult Jews, is necessary to say the Kaddish, the traditional prayer said by mourners. Having reached their 8th or 9th decade, they have needed that quorum in the past for parents, siblings, and even children. They come early to enable other Jews to mourn their losses. Today, they are the ones we mourn. There is an irony about this tragedy. Now is arguably a golden age for American Jews. Universities that once enforced quotas limiting enrollment of Jewish students have presidents who are Jews. Resorts that once forbade Jews host Passover retreats. Law firms that once rejected Jewish applicants now ensure that kosher food is available at partners' meetings. Structural anti-Semitism, the kind of anti-Semitism practiced by governments and institutions, is at an unprecedented low. But that's only half the story. Acts of anti-Semitism have increased exponentially in recent years. American Jews have expressed heightened concerns about this. Yet, they may have a myopic view of the problem. Many American Jews worry about anti-Semitism that comes from the political left. They see those on the left vilifying Israel in a fashion that is applied to no other country. Sometimes they see Jews denied something to no other people, a national identity. But the organized community has not shown the same concerns about anti-Semitism on the right. In recent decades, there has been a rise in hate groups. We witnessed an uptick during the Obama administration, possibly as a right-wing response to having an African-American as president. These groups emerged with newfound strength during the 2016 presidential campaign. They now feel they have gained a certain legitimacy in the eyes of the government. I do not mean to suggest that the administration is explicitly saying their nationalism and white supremacy are acceptable. The suggestions are far from explicit. Ergo, there were, quote, very fine people on both sides, unquote, in Charlottesville. Their version of America, their vision of America, is one that is white and Christian. And Jews should not deceive themselves for a moment. In these folks' eyes, Jews are neither. The vast majority of these anti-Semites, however vile their ideas, would never commit violence. However, there are the extremists. For these deranged, hate-laden folks, their leaders' divisive rhetoric becomes verbal ammunition that inspires them to build pipe bombs or take AR-15s into a synagogue. If the murder of 11 innocent people can teach us anything, what lessons might we learn? Do not look for haters only on the other side of the political transom. Those on the political left who see anti-Semitism only on the right have blinded themselves to what is happening in their own midst. Those on the political right who are concerned only about the, quote, lefties, unquote, on campus and beyond are blind to what is happening next to them. We may never change the minds of people who send pipe bombs, but we can stop them from influencing others. This year, at Thanksgiving dinner, when your curmudgeon uncle or successful cousin, parenthetically, not all haters are old and ornery, begins to rant about Jews, blacks, Muslims, and LGBTQs who are ruining this country, do not sit idly by. Challenge them. Do so not to change their minds, but to reach others who are listening and learning. Silence is an imprimatur for hate and prejudice. Do not think this attack is only about Jews. It may start with the Jews, but it never ends there. And conversely, it may start with others, Muslims, African Americans, LGBTQ identifying folks. But it will ultimately reach Jews. Lost in the legitimate media attention to the Pittsburgh attack was the murder a few days earlier of two African Americans by a white man. He had tried to gain access to a predominantly African American church, but found the doors locked. Instead, he went to a nearby supermarket and killed two black senior citizens. In Jewish tradition, upon mourning the dead, we say, may their memory be for a blessing. Today we should say, may the memory of all those killed and the suffering of those who have been wounded be for a blessing and for a lesson we ignore at our personal, national, and moral risk. Entire article read. Article is by Deborah E. Lipstadt. That's spelled Lipstadt, author of Anti-Semitism Here and Now. Moving forward to the section called World, the headline is Brazil's Shock to the System. President-elect Bolsonaro swept in from the far right. Article by Matt Sandy, Dateline, Rio de Janeiro. The din in Brazil's lower house of Congress was so loud, the seven-term congressman running for speaker could barely be heard. His colleagues paid little attention. many speaking over him. Unperturbed, Jair Messias Bolsonaro forged on, waving a newspaper as he railed against his ineffective contemporaries. The former army captain, then 62, won just 4 of the 504 votes that day in February 2017, a result that seemed to confirm his irrelevance in Brazilian politics. Yet an aide who was streaming his diatribe live on Facebook, where it received 450,000 views and accelerated his nascent political movement. Just 21 months later, Bolsonaro has the full attention not only of Brazil, but of a wary world. He was elected president on October 28th with nearly 58 million votes. It was a political earthquake. For Latin America's largest nation, the impact of a far-right candidate's assuming control of its young democracy rivals the election of Donald Trump to the U.S. or the Brexit vote to Europe. Bolsonaro, initially known mainly for his hateful invective at women, gays, and racial minorities, rode a storm of anger at a deeply corrupt political class, at the country's worst ever recession, and one of the highest homicide rates on earth. Quote, "That chaos was paid for by poorer people without resources. Unemployment and violence hit them more," unquote, says Rodrigo Constantino, a political commentator. Brazil's elite live in a bubble, he adds. Quote, "They interact with the same people, read the same newspapers, eat the same food, go to the same places, and lost touch with the people," unquote. On the campaign trail, Bolsonaro promised to meet violence with greater violence, playing to the fears of a population traumatized by 175 murders a day. He spoke of a future free from the corruption and crime many voters associated with the establishment in general, and specifically his opponent, Fernando Haddad's Workers' Party, which led Brazil for 13 of the past 15 years. Carlo Ferrazon, a 45-year-old Bolsonaro campaigner, expressed the anger that many in Brazil felt at the political class. Quote, "Whoever didn't win the elections didn't listen to the streets," unquote, she said. Quote, "The other parties thought they had a monopoly on power and would get what they wanted. How many lifelong politicians weren't elected? This is a result of our work," unquote. The question is what Brazil will look like under a president who has lionized Brazil's 1964-85 dictatorship, when state-sanctioned torture and murder was rife. He told Time in an August interview that he now fully endorses democracy, although he intends to appoint several generals to key ministerial positions. But his pledge did not stop him threatening his left-wing opponents less than 2 weeks ago with exile or jail. Quote, "When facing grave difficulties, our country has repeatedly chosen authoritarianism," unquote, says historian Lilia Moritz-Schwartz, the co-author of Brazil, A Biography, citing colonialism and slavery as factors that created a patrimonial, highly violent society. Quote, "This bet on Bolsonaro now comes as no surprise," unquote. Others doubt Bolsonaro will embrace autocracy now that he has won power by democratic means. Quote, "We have strong institutions with strong communications, an active civil society, and a military that is neutral and distant from politics," says, unquote, says Jairo Nicolau, a political scientist at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Quote, "This is not a banana republic," unquote. Yet, human rights defenders, civil rights groups, and environmentalists fear the direction Brazil will go under its new president. The election led to an alarming spike in aggression against the LGBT community and leftists, parenthetically, and in fact, against Bolsonaro himself, who was stabbed in the abdomen while campaigning. Journalists alone have faced 141 instances of threats or violence. Quote, Bolsonaro said, if we don't leave the country, he will throw us in jail, unquote, says Diva Santana of Tortura Nunca Mais, a group that is still fighting for justice for those tortured and, quote, disappeared, unquote, by the military regime 33 years after it ended. Quote, but I'm not leaving. I'm not afraid of him, not a little bit, unquote. Julio Moreira of Grupo Arco Iris, a national LGBT association, took the opposite view. Quote, we may have to self-exile in order to reconstruct the country later, unquote, he said, expressing fears of homophobic attacks. Quote, it is more important to survive and guarantee our rights down the line, unquote. Environmental groups say his promise to give carte blanche to loggers, miners, and agribusiness in the Amazon rainforest could increase attacks on environmental defenders. 46 were killed in Brazil last year. Although Bolsonaro has yet to announce a detailed policy blueprint, he pledged to address Brazil's record homicide rate, which hit 63,880 in 2017, by relaxing gun laws and giving police more freedom to kill. That will only make matters worse, says Silva Ramos of the Center for Studies on Public Security and Citizenship. Quote, only someone who is in despair would think that introducing more guns, more police brutality, and more incarceration will lead to a reduction in criminality, unquote. But some who live in Brazil's most crime-ridden urban areas say that things can't get much worse. Carley Lima, 23, who lives in a Rio de Janeiro favela, said revolutionary solutions are called for. Quote, we only respect what we fear. Unfortunately, that's the way it works. The country will only change if something radical happens, unquote, he said. Then there's Brazil's economy, which is saddled with a crippling budgetary deficit and hefty unemployment rates. Bolsonaro has promised to pull Brazil out of crisis by privatizing state companies, pushing through a painful reform of the pension system, and opening Brazil further to foreign investors, moves that won him crucial business support. But the left is likely to resist that with widespread labor action beginning in January, predicts Raul Luiz Murad, director of the Instituto Liberal think tank. Quote, these won't be easy times for the president and for the country, unquote. That might give Bolsonaro a confrontation he would relish. But it remains to be seen whether the army of enthusiastic supporters he built up over the election would stand by him if he decides to remake Brazil entirely. Polls show most Bolsonaro voters do not actually share his radical views, but wanted to cause a huge upheaval in the political system. On that front, at least, Brazil's new president has already delivered. And Time reminds us that that article was by Matt Sandy, Dateline Rio de Janeiro, and at the end of the article points out, with reporting by Shauna Hanbury, Dateline Rio de Janeiro. As a follow-up to that article is a section called Viewpoint, where the headline is, Brazil Joins the League of Strongmen Nations, by Ian Bremmer. When Donald Trump was first elected U.S. president, there were few like-minded elected leaders in other countries. seated next to unapologetic globalists like Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Trump always seemed the odd man out, and more so after President Emmanuel Macron's election in France 6 months after his. Trump's unapologetic, sometimes belligerent nationalism made him an awkward aberration and a problem the globalists wanted to solve. Things have changed. In one polarized nation after another, strongmen are now in vogue. While Macron suffers domestically and Merkel plans to wrap up her chancellorship of Germany by 2021, populist nationalists are thriving at the top of the world's largest democracies, from Trump himself to India's Narendra Modi, to the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte, to Italy's strongman, Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini. To that list, we can now add Brazil and Jair Bolsonaro. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, benefited from it, and please be sure to listen next time. This is Randall Rickman reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleredingservice.org. That's triangleredingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Number again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time, this is your loyal, dedicated reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you for being with us, and we sure appreciate your patience with your humble reader. And we hope you will join us once again for Time.